The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is brought to you by Squarespace, the award-winning website creation platform that helps you make the front page. With Getty image integration and elegant templates, you can give your viewers the whole picture. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up on the show, we look at our journey from logic to modern computers and the revolutionary proposition of quantum computing. Plus, could already licensed drugs help in the fight against Alzheimer's disease and the peculiar reproductive habits of the hermaphrodite flatworm. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. The annual Royal Society Summer Science Exhibition shows off the best of British science, highlighting the place of scientific innovation at the heart of our culture and of our economic well-being. The exhibition dates back to the early 19th century when the Royal Society's president invited guests to his home to inspect collections of scientific instruments and other objects illustrating the newest scientific research. These days, it's an exhibition with a huge range of events, and on this and next week's podcast, we'll be looking at four of them. This week, we're going to explore the impact maths and logic has had on modern computing and whether quantum computing is a realistic prospect. I'm joined down the line by Vlatko Vedral, Professor of Physics at Oxford University. And in the studio, we have Patrick Fitzpatrick, Emeritus Professor of Mathematics at University College Cork, The Guardian Science Correspondent, Hannah Devlin, and Phil Oldfield, our British Science Association Media Fellow. Patrick, you organised a lecture at the Royal Society about George Boole, this self-taught mathematician who became a pioneer of the computing age. A lot of people may not have heard of George Boole. Who was he? What did he actually do that made such a difference?
George Boole came to Cork in 1849. He was the first professor of mathematics at Queen's College Cork, which is now University College Cork. He was from Lincoln in England, a self-taught mathematician. While he was in Cork, he made his research, turned logic into a branch of mathematics, essentially, into a branch of algebra.
So what is Boolean logic? People hear about Boolean logic, which I presume is named after him. What is it?
Well, it's a way of treating logic by algebra. So we have propositions which can be true or false, and we can talk about propositions in pairs, whether something, one proposition and another proposition is true, or whether one proposition or another proposition is true. And all of that can be brought together into a mathematical formulation, which makes it easier to handle logic computations.
And say, how does this particularly lend itself to digital computing? Is there something about Boolean logic that is just very well or easily represented by ones and zeros?
Well, in 1937, Claude Shannon showed how Boolean algebra is exactly the mathematical tool that could be used to analyse switching circuits which were used for routing telephone calls in complex systems. And because these systems were becoming more and more complex, they needed algebraic tools to work out how they would work and to design the systems. It was then noticed that because switches have values 0 or 1, on or off, that you could then use these switches to do mathematical calculations. That led to the creation of the electronic computer.
How does this maths hold up when you want to move on to this sort of next wave of computers that people are looking at, quantum computers, and presumably the motivation for those being that there is only so far you can go with classical computers, that you can only get so many transistors so small on such a smaller an area that you want to start looking at other types of computing?
Yeah, that's precisely the case. I think the latest Intel chip has transistors which are around about 14 nanometers. The size of a silicon atom is about one-third of a nanometer. So you won't be able to go much smaller than the 14 or the 10, perhaps. So we're reaching the limit of the construction of traditional computers, and people are looking to what could possibly be the next new paradigm for computing, which could be quantum computing.
Vlatko, can we bring you in here? Can you just take us through what actually a quantum computer is?
Yes. So the basic idea is to extend the Boolean logic that we talked about. And rather than just having a zero state and a one state, What quantum physics allows you is to have a superposition. So that's a state which is in between the zero state and the one state, and it combines the zero and one in whichever actually proportion you'd like to have it. And this is very powerful because the classical computer, the conventional computer, can store either a zero or a one at any given instant in time when it's computing. But actually, a quantum computer could then follow simultaneously the branch that contains zero and one. And this, in principle, can really lead to a huge speed up.
Could I ask, Vladko, it's quite easy to imagine how a one or a zero could be represented. Patrick was talking about switches. But when you're talking about these superpositions of ones and zeros, what is that physically?
Yes, physically, I think probably the easiest thing to imagine is to have an electron that's going around the nucleus in an atom. You know, take your typical atom and think about the energy states where the electron can be very close to the nucleus or a bit further away from the nucleus. So these two states could be your zero and your one state. And if you shine some light onto this atom, you can actually move the electron from the position where it's close to the nucleus to the one where it's further away. And that would be like your basic NOT gate. You'll be going from the state zero to the state one. But what quantum mechanics also says is that you could be somewhere in between these two. If you shine light for the appropriate amount of time, then you will be exactly between the state zero and the state one. In fact, you could have them at the same time. And I think that's how you can visualize a quantum bit.
Right. And is that what people call a quantum bit or a qubit then?
That's exactly what people call a qubit. A quantum bit is a generalization of the Boolean classical bit, where in addition to having just the state zero and the state one, you can have all states in between the state zero and one. So simultaneously in any proportion, the logical zeros and ones.
To me, Vladko, that sounds as if it makes something fairly simple very complicated by introducing a fuzziness. And I'm wondering how you get concrete results out of something like that. If you say, well, we know the result somewhere between yes and no, I'm not sure how helpful that is. I know I'm missing something, but I'm hoping you can explain what I've got wrong.
No, you didn't get anything wrong. It's a very good point, in fact. And I think that our initial discussion went in that direction to say that chips are getting smaller and smaller, and at some point they will hit this quantum fuzziness. And the question is, can we turn that apparent disadvantage, and I think the industry may well view this as a disadvantage at some level, can we turn that into an advantage where the fuzziness now gives you more power? And I think the idea is to really combine zeros and ones in the right proportion so that at the end, when you make a measurement to extract the result, and this is how you get rid of fuzziness, you make a measurement and that gives you a concrete outcome. At the end, you really want to steer your outcome with a very high probability towards the desired result. So in most cases, quantum computers will be fuzzy still, and you will not get your answer with certainty at the end. But actually, if you repeat your computation a few times, then you can amplify the probability to any desired accuracy. And even with this repetition, we can actually show that quantum computers would be much more powerful than classical ones.
Patrick, can I ask you what sort of applications people have got in mind for quantum computers?
Well, I think that there are many problems where the only solution by a classical computer is to search through all the possible solutions one by one. And that can take a very, very long time. For example, the current crypto systems, which are used to protect financial transactions on the internet and so on, all have that property, which is essentially that you have a key which is hidden in a very, very large space, and that the attacker can only search through that space one key at a time. The quantum computer could look at all of the keys at the same time and essentially pick out the right answer in a limited length of time. So if a quantum computer could be built, I would suggest then that that would mean our crypto systems would have to change.
That doesn't necessarily sound like a good thing, Patrick. Is that something that people are worried about?
Well, it has happened many times in the past that crypto systems have been attacked and beaten, and that's what cryptographers do. I mean, you know about the Enigma crypto system, which was beaten by Alan Turing and other people in Bletchley Park. Even more recently, the new public key crypto systems that were invented in the late 70s had previously been invented in GCHQ in secret. So I think that security services, governments are all looking at the idea of quantum computing and trying to be prepared for the eventuality that such a thing could really be built. And they will find algorithms and so on that can be safe still on a quantum computer. Maybe Vladko might like to comment on that.
I think that's absolutely right. In fact, I think the transformation has already taken place as far as, for example, highly sensitive governmental documents that we know have to basically remain secret for 50 years and only get public after that. I think the encryption that's used on them has already taken into account the fact that quantum computers might be made between now and 50 years' time. So they've already readjusted, even though we don't have a large-scale quantum computer and it's still just an idea, I think the governments have actually adjusted to this fact.
Vladko, what do you think it will take for these things to become a reality? Can, in your mind, these really be built today?
I'm optimistic about it. I think today we are talking about maybe between 10 and 20 quantum bits. Whichever technology we follow, with optics or with atoms or with superconductors, I don't think we can go far beyond 10 quantum bits, which still, doesn't allow you to do anything really better than with a classical conventional computer. But I think we will be relatively soon in a position to scale this up. And going beyond, let's say, 100 quantum bits already gives you enough advantage over classical computers, because this is a space, this is the amount of the size of this computer is 2 to the power of 100, if you like. And that's certainly much bigger than any conventional computer can handle. But I think to bridge the gap between 20 qubits and 100 or 1,000 qubits is highly non-trivial, because we don't really know. We don't have the right technology at present to do this in a stable way. So what we have to do is introduce a huge degree of redundancy, usually, to make quantum computers stable. So effectively, even one logical qubit requires, let's say, 100 physical qubits, just in order to distill one accurate logical qubit. And in this sense, it just very quickly escalates this calculation. And I think we need something much more stable than what we have.
Vladko, when you talk about a stable system, what do you mean by that? And could you just tell us a bit about what these systems are like that have got 10 qubits, quantum bits at the moment?
Yes, at the moment, for example, if you look at trapped atoms, they are probably the best technology that we have currently. And what this entails is confining 10 atoms to a very small space using lasers, actually. So the space is a micron in size, so one millionth of a meter, if you like. And what you have to do is you have to cool them down to a very low temperature, usually a billionth of a Kelvin. These are really the coldest temperatures in the universe. And you also do that with lasers. The reason why you do that is because you don't want the atoms to move around as you try to encode and process information with them. So there's all sorts of noises there which are of thermal origin, and the higher the temperature, the more they move about. And this is one thing that you definitely have to be able to suppress in order to get a genuine quantum register. And then on top of it, you are talking about noise as you start to compute. So there are all sorts of imperfections in the way you address these atoms. And each of these imperfections have to be reduced below a certain size. And only then we can call that a genuine quantum computer.
Vladko, people might think that the progress in computing will sort of end up with us having just smaller, faster, better computers. But as we're talking through this, I'm wondering if we're going to actually see what might appear to be a sort of shift back to the days of rooms, computers that fill rooms, because you need all the cooling, you need the lasers. I mean, presumably these things aren't going to run on laptop batteries and be something you can take on a train commute.
Absolutely right. That's exactly what it looks like now. If you go back to 1940s and look at the computers at that point, I think we have something very similar as far as quantum computers are now. It's very hard to make that small enough, that kind of cooling, you know, laser cooling technology, to make it small enough to fit it into a typical laptop. It seems to me, and I think it seems to quite a few of my colleagues as well, that we do require a different kind of technology. Let me give you an example. Suppose we discover a really high temperature superconductor. So let's say room temperature superconductor. So this would be a superconductor that would actually be quantum mechanical even at room temperature. We don't have anything like that now. We have to cool things down to very low temperatures in order to make them really superconduct. If we had a room temperature superconductor, something that's already quantum mechanical at room temperature, I think this would be a perfect basis for a quantum bit. And then it could well be that you could just scale it up easily without worrying about all the cooling technology that needs to go around it. And this would then provide something that's really fully scalable and genuinely quantum mechanical. So that's one possible direction, I would say.
People already started trying to commercialize this technology, the Canadian company D-Wave quantum computer out, but people are struggling to show that that actually performs better than classical computers. Why do you think that's the case? Why do you think it's not very clearly outperforming the computers it's checked against?
I think they could replace classical computers completely. I think the application in cryptography that we discussed is indeed very specialized. But actually, the generic search problem that the quantum computer could solve, in fact, lies at the root of most difficult problems that we are facing. So I think that the typical example is the traveling salesman. So this is a person that has to go between a certain number of cities and visit them only once, ideally, and find the minimum route that connects all of these cities. And the number of possible routes quickly escalates with the number of cities. So this is something that grows really exponentially quickly. And the conventional computer already finds it hard to solve this with let's say, 100 or certainly 1,000 cities. And this is exactly one of those areas where a quantum computer would be much better. But given that, you know, most problems that we are facing are of this kind of nature, where you have to search for the optimum, then I think a quantum computer would replace the classical one for all of them.
Patrick, where does this leave Boole? Does his logic have to be adapted for these new types of computers, or can it just run on through? I mean, you're still using ones and zeros.
You're still using ones and zeros, and I think that it's still the basis. The Boolean algebra and logic are still the basis. But I would say that, you know, even if a quantum computer could be made smaller, we're not going to do word processing on a quantum computer. And I think that the conventional computers, they are so powerful now that we're not going to throw them away and in favor of quantum computers. So Boolean logic is still here to stay for quite a long time.
I think D-Wave is an amazing piece of engineering, and it really is put together in a beautiful way. It's much smaller than what we discussed. You know, it really resembles much more a conventional computer than your typical physics laboratory for cooling atoms. But what they can do is they can only do a very, very limited set of operations. So you know, if the computer that they have is quantum, it's quantum in an extremely, extremely limited sense, that it can only perform one thing, basically. And it's definitely not universal in the way we'd like to have it. So what we'd like to do is, if you claim you have, let's say, 1,000 qubits, which is, I think, what they claim they have, maybe even more now, then we'd like that to mean that you can make any physical operation that you could possibly imagine, you could actually implement that on these 1,000 qubits. But the D-Wave company cannot do that. They can only do one very specific thing with their computer. So it's extremely specialized and limited. But I think it's a great step forward, because it shows you that people out there in industry and business are taking the idea seriously, and they're trying to develop it and miniaturize it and make it more like the conventional technology. And I think D-Wave is not the only company now. I think there are a few other companies that are invested. I think Google has invested into a laboratory in Santa Barbara. I think Microsoft has something. I think there are a few small startups in Berkeley California as well. So I think, you know, there is a momentum, and I think it's growing.
Flacco, how long do you think it's going to be before we see some of this stuff really make an impact on, you know, our everyday lives?
Oh, I think we're talking about timescales that are basically beyond 10 years as it stands. You know, there is this 2020 horizon where I think the investment, for example, that's been given to us here in UK, the projection is that by 2020 we might be able to handle something like an array of 20 by 20 quantum bits. And this, I think, would already be, if you had a stable memory of this kind, that would already be a first huge step towards making a quantum computer. But I think we need to go really well beyond that and be able to address them and implement all sorts of gates and measurements. And I think we're talking certainly beyond 10, 20 years time.
When you want the whole picture, you choose The Guardian. When you want to create your own, you choose Squarespace, the all-in-one website building platform that lets you buy domains, create your own logo, and more. Whatever you want to showcase, Squarespace gives you simple yet powerful tools and elegant designs to make any idea brilliant. Create your own picture at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
To this week's science news. Hannah, you've been writing about Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah, so this was a presentation that was given this week at the Alzheimer's Society conference in Manchester. And it's a follow-up to a very big paper that came out in 2013, which raised for the first time the prospect of something that could treat Alzheimer's. The reason why people were so excited about it was the first thing that was shown to be able to halt brain cell death in mice. So it's still early stage, we're still not talking about doing this in patients, but it was seen as incredibly promising, and it has also taken a completely different approach to previous approaches to treating Alzheimer's. The problem with the compound that they used in that paper was that it was very toxic and it had all sorts of horrible side effects that made it completely inappropriate to use in humans. And this paper given this week was reproducing the results but using two licensed drugs that are already widely used for conditions that aren't related to dementia. And so the idea is that you could, with a few more steps in the lab, you'd be able to fairly quickly put those into a clinical trial of patients.
Do they know anything about how these drugs are working?
Yeah, so what's interesting about the research is that it's really shifting things away from focusing on these sticky tangles of proteins called plaques that you see in the brains of Alzheimer's patients. They're focusing instead on a faulty defence mechanism in the brain that they think might be the problem. So Giovanna Malucci, who carried out the research at the University of Cambridge, her theory is that the plaques are just the visible symptoms of Alzheimer's. They're not what causes the real problems. The problems start when your brain switches off protein production in response to these plaques and stops all the essential proteins that are needed to repair brain cells. It stops those from being produced as well. And so what these drugs do is they turn down that defence mechanism. They block an enzyme called PERK, which is involved in the defence mechanism, and allow the protein production to be switched on again. And that seemed to completely transform the course of the disease in these mice. And so you still saw the plaques. They still had all this stuff accumulating, but it just didn't hurt their brain cells anymore. And the hope is that the same thing would happen in Alzheimer's patients.
And they use two drugs. Would the idea be to use those same two drugs in Alzheimer's patients?
They screened through hundreds of licensed drugs to try and find something that could produce this effect that was safe to use. And they found three things that look very promising, and two of them they've already got the results in the mice that show they were able to replicate the effect. I think the next step really before they start trying drugs is to make sure that this mechanism is really doing the same thing in humans. And so the next thing that they want to do is some brain scanning in patients to just really firm up that link before going into a trial.
If these drugs are already used in people for other conditions, and it sounds like we're not allowed to know what the drugs are, can they not round up a load of people who are already on those drugs and just see if they have the typical amount of Alzheimer's disease among them.
So the researchers have intentionally not revealed what the drugs are. They're for conditions not related to dementia, but they don't want people to go out and start trying to take them to just treat themselves. I guess maybe there would be a signal in epidemiological data. It just really depends what's out there. And without knowing what diseases these are used to treat, it's hard to say whether that data exists or not.
And finally, Phil, your podcast debut, what are you going to tell us about?
Well, we've got the story of some very interesting flatworms that are quite common but have been discovered to have a reproductive plan B for when they're on their own. Basically, scientists in Germany have found these flatworms prefer to mate in groups like most of us, but when left on their own, they are able to inject themselves in their own heads using a needle-like penis to have hermaphroditic reproduction. The reason they do this is because when they're on their own, they don't have any of a chance to mate. So this is this kind of plan B action to get some offspring.
Have they actually seen them doing this?
They haven't seen them doing it. No, in the study, they took some of these flatworms and kept some in groups and they kept some individually. And then they, under a microscope, measured the sperm in the different places within the flatworms and found the ones that were on their own had much higher amounts of sperm in the head and in the middle of the body. And this sperm will swim and burrow through the body down to the tail to fertilise the eggs.
But they are pretty sure that the worm itself did it to itself. It wasn't another worm coming along and...
No. This is the only option, really, that they think can happen. They kept the worms very much in isolation. And, they believe that the worms are injecting themselves in the head with their own sperm.
And isn't it marvellous that scientists somewhere are working on this?
Well, yes. You know, I feel sorry for the poor scientist who had to count the sperm in 100 of these microscopic flatworms. But, you know, the results are interesting, definitely.
More worm news next week, hopefully. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Patrick Fitzpatrick, Vlatko Vedral, Hannah Devlin and Phil Oldfield. From me, Ian Sample and all the science team, thanks for listening.